there, Shopomaniacs! You're listening to another episode of the Shop Talk Show, a podcast all about front-end web design and development. I'm Dave Rupert, and with me is Chris Coyer.
Hey, Dave. We're kind of rounding out the end of our, little kind of mini-series talking about the JavaScript-based ecosystem of today. And I think we have the perfect guest for the end of that series, and that's Guillermo Rausch. Hey, Guillermo. How you doing, man?
Great. How are you guys?
Good. And you do so much great stuff for the, first of all, everybody should follow Guillermo on Twitter. Hilarious. Good Twitter follow, I have to say.
I think half my computer is Guillermo Rausch products. I'm not sure.
There's probably it's interesting to think about you as a whole, because there's all these big major projects that are all kind of under the Zeit umbrella in a way. And so Zeit itself, maybe you just tell us what Zeit is and the different kind of components of it as you think about it.
Yeah, it's a global company whose mission is to bring cloud computing to everyone in the world. And obviously cloud computing is very broad, but the way that we're getting started is we're making serverless compute more accessible, meaning that you can deploy any website or application instantly, whether you Git push and you get a URL from us of your deployment, bring your website online in seconds, or you use our Now tool to write Now in a terminal and you get your deployment ready. And we also are very famous for our Next.js framework, which is a React framework. And because we had kind of like the same idea that we should make deployment simple, creating a React app was not simple enough. And everything we do is React. We love React. So we looked around and we're like, oh, this is too hard. So the company tries to create the best developer tools that are ergonomic, that are open source or free to use, and yeah, bring them to as many people as we can.
Maybe some people's first experience with Zeit is Now, because it's, it's so satisfying to have like a URL for the thing that you built. You're working locally. That ship has already been established, fortunately, in the world of working on computers. People learning these days, that's how they learn. They make a directory in their local computer and they build stuff and they NPM install stuff and whatever they're doing, especially if what they're doing with what they're learning is JavaScript.
For sure.
Focused. And then what? You have maybe even a local server going, and it's somewhat satisfying to work on stuff. But there's always that final step of getting it to an actual website. And it's kind of a fun part in a way. Like, some people take to that and maybe they turn into DevOps people someday or something. But, I remember what it was like in my early days. I'm like, I bought a domain name. I managed to do it somehow. I figured this out myself. And then I got an email that gave me FTP credentials and I figured out how that works. And I found some freeware FTP client and I've managed to get myself connected somehow.
Or you bought one.
Yeah, perhaps I've paid for one and dragged and dropped some files in there. And I guess I put them in the right place, because now my website is showing up and I had to hand deal with DNS and stuff. And sometimes that stuff is still fun. Like, I do some of that stuff once in a while, but it is, wow, is that ever a barrier? I could see how a curriculum at a school might just be like, okay, here's what we're going to do now. You have your little project going. Type Now.
Right.
And actually,
since you mentioned like DNS and there's also SSL certificates to make the connection encrypted and secure. And what's great is we do all that for the developer, but then we also expose all the underlying layers. So it's not that we're trying to give you some like magic potion and lock you in and then you never learn about all the pieces or you lose the ability to customize. So what's beautiful is you run Now, you get your deployment going, and then you can peel back the layers if you wanted to. And like you said, for example, like if you want to associate your deployment with a domain name, we handle all that DNS configuration, all the TLS configuration for SSL certificates. Mm-hmm. It's all for free, thanks to Let's Encrypt. You get kind of the best of both worlds, which is why I'm so excited about this, because it is unusual that you get a good experience as someone that's just getting started, and then you actually get a scalable experience if you're getting a ton of traffic or your project is really growing and really getting traction.
So it's best of both worlds in all ways. It's easy and configurable, and it's for little sites and huge sites. You kind of cover the whole spectrum there.
And that was kind of like our inspiration was, you know, like companies like Apple, like they have put out a lot of ecosystems that have been so great in that divide, right? Like the, if you think about the current iOS ecosystem where, you know, they even now teach you Swift on the iPad with Swift Playgrounds. I think all the platforms are kind of converging into this idea that you have to serve the creator at all levels of their sort of expertise.
Yeah.
Kind of noob and pro. Consumer, pro.
Yeah, I think and in many ways, we're all new to technologies all the time. A neat thing about now is that we never married ourselves to one programming language or one technology or one framework. So we're obviously fans of React, but we have a tons of Vue users, for example.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think I always associate you with the React kind of deployment system, and that's probably because of Next, which we can talk about. But now in itself is kind of just a node server, but you can also, it looks like you serve PHP and all kinds of things, right? It's kind of,
yeah, because then there,
yeah, let's get into that in a minute. But first I'd like to be like, so if I just create React app and I have a little create React app going, I would just assume that it's going to work on now. And it probably does. But how does it though? Does it need a dist folder or what's the magic that makes that? Is it going to run some script from my package.json? I assume it will pull all my dependencies for me, or do I have to push my node modules folder? Like how does it work?
So you can run the build locally if you wanted to, right? Like you said earlier, like you can bring in your NPM dependencies and all this kind of stuff. And then you get a dist directory with create React app, for example, or pretty much with every like static site generator. And then you could say, hey, like now deploy this folder. But the way that we promote doing is we can actually run the build in the cloud. And there are lots of benefits to doing that, especially when you start realizing that, oh, my node modules directory is out of date, or, you know, it gets really, really big and you want to sort of keep a cache. For example, you can keep a cache in the cloud so that all your builds get faster and faster, which is really nice. So typically what you do is like in your package.json file, you set up a script that's called now-build. And okay. You say there like Gatsby build or create React app build or whatever it is. And then in now.json file, it tells, hey, I want to build this with Node.js. So we bring in NPM or Yarn and run the build and then serve your directory. But that's what I was mentioning earlier. Like there are a lot of people out there that don't use Node. So what's neat about now is that it's just as friendly for the Node.js developer, JavaScript developer, as it is to like even native developers. But since we come from the JavaScript community, we wanted to like make this experience like as easy as writing a package.json file, which you probably already have.
Yeah, yeah. And your little repo, it doesn't even have to be a repo, right? Your little local directory could be just an index.html file if it wanted to.
Or
it could run the Vue CLI. Or this was surprising to me, is can it just be like an index.php file? It'll run PHP?
Yeah, so that's the beauty of it. We have this concept of what we call builders. So for those of you in the audience that are familiar with Heroku, you can kind of think of now as Heroku for serverless, meaning there's no process that you have to monitor or observe. There is no dyno. You actually pay by 100 milliseconds of execution instead of paying for like a monthly price of a server. But what's really neat is this concept of builders. So you can say, hey, all my PHP files use now/PHP. So now that /PHP is another open source project, which is an NPM module, which will wrap your code, your PHP code in this case, and make it work serverlessly. So the beauty of it is any kind of code that you have in your directory or in your repo can be packaged and run in the cloud. And you didn't have to do any of the building, any of the packaging, any of the cloud configuration. So like I said, it works just as well as for PHP as it is for, you know, create a React app.
Oh, I think a lot of PHP apps are kind of, you know, like built on a framework like
Laravel
or something. Yep. That's kind of just like a RESTful server. And like that's kind of serverless is, you know, bread and butter.
Yeah, right? Exactly. So one of the things that we set out to do with now is like, okay, like what are the things that are not going to change in 10 years? And in my opinion, that's protocols. So TLS, SSL, HTTP, they do evolve, right? Like the HTTP has become HTTP 1.0, 1.1, HTTP 2, and now they're coming out with HTTP 3. But all your apps are always backwards compatible from a protocol standpoint. Same with like TLS. We went through TLS 1.0, had a lot of bugs. 1.1, now we're 1.2, now we're going to 1.3, and it's being deployed right now. All those things just work for the end user. However, technologies change a lot, right? Like the frameworks tend to be more of a faster changing ecosystem, at least. I mean, I was doing, you know, MooTools first, I was doing jQuery next, and today I'm doing React, and you know, who knows what we're going to do in 5 years. So our take was, okay, how can we help developers get it started instantly and yet retain that flexibility to be completely future-proof? So we handle all the protocol stuff for you, like I said, like DNS, SSL, et cetera. And then we expose this little like JavaScript builders that will wrap your code, build it if necessary, and this build will happen in the cloud. And then when that build completes, the outputs of that build is what matters to us. So the outputs could be static files. So as you mentioned, Chris, when you build with Create React App, it gives you a dist folder with a bunch of static files. So that's one potential output of the builders. And the other one that is super interesting is this Lambda functions concept. So Lambda functions are kind of like static files. They kind of get distributed in our CDN, just like static files. But when you hit them as a user, when you request them, they can execute dynamic code. Right. Exactly. So it's a beautiful model because what I always say is that if you've ever used a CDN, you never stress that your CDN will stop working in the middle of the night, will not scale. Like you're like, oh my God, I cannot serve enough logo.png. That never happens. But with Lambda functions, you put your code side by side, those static assets at the CDN edge. And then when the requests come in, when your users come, they get executed. So it's kind of magical. And we make it very open. We make it very transparent. We make it multi-cloud provider. We make it multi-language, multi-framework.
So you're using the word Lambda, but that which happens to be an AWS word, but it doesn't.
Correct.
It doesn't matter. It could be. It's just a cloud function. Yeah.
So AWS kind of pioneered this concept, but nowadays there's quite a steady inflow of competitors to this space. So the idea is that cloud function today. One example is AWS Lambda, Google Cloud Functions, Azure Functions. But what's beautiful about now is that you focus solely on standards compliant code. So you kind of write the code the way that you've been writing it all your life. And then at packaging time, we're sort of deploying them with all the cloud providers. And this is what our customers really don't want to do. Our customers don't want to log into like a cloud infrastructure provider console. They don't want to twist and turn the knobs. Most likely, you just want, you know, like, you know this very well.
No, it's terrible. It's terrible. I've done it. You know, especially, none of them do it particularly well, which is why the other companies are having success in it too. Like, you know, not that you want to sit around and talk about your competitors, but just think of a big one like serverless.com, which
for
really
sure
helps you with this.
Absolutely. You know? Absolutely. And I think, you know, it's a very exciting space. I think when you think about, okay, like, if I had to build an application the best way I know today, you kind of always want this sort of new traits, right? Like you would want to reach every person in the world instantly. So deployment used to be very much confined to, I picked one AWS region or I picked one Google Cloud region, and then I booted up my server there. But at the rate that businesses are evolving today, you kind of want to be wherever your customer is and you want to be right there. So serverless kind of gives you this, you know, like in a very, very natural way. And our job is we take your code and we place it right where you need it without doing any configuration. We've had customers that were, for example, very California-centric in the beginning of their business lifetime. And then they started spreading in the US and then they became international. And they never had to reconfigure anything. Never reconfigured an internal VPC network or a load balancer or in placement group or auto-scaling group. Like, I could go on and on and on about all the jargon that our amazing DevOps team knows, but luckily our customers don't need to learn about, really.
I went through the process of setting up a AWS with a load balancer and, you know, in a staging environment and all this stuff like recently, and it was nightmare fuel. It was really difficult and awful, but I like that y'all handle that. And you're kind of going for latest best practices too.
For sure. And as I was saying, I think those have a place, but they have a place in you know, very, very, very special and specific circumstances. And what's neat about serverless, in my opinion, is that most of the stuff we do is inherently serverless. So this is kind of one of the keys to me. Even though we can write some things as servers, the nature of what we're doing is serverless. What do I mean by this? When you were writing, for example, like PHP back in the day, and you were mentioning like uploading it to the FTP, of course there was a server somewhere. In general, it was something like Apache or Nginx. But when you were writing PHP, you were kind of focusing on, I'm writing the request logic, right? I'm writing only my business logic. And that's a really nice thing, because you can sort of separate your code, the one that matters to your customers, from the server code, the one that matters to like protocol developers or, you know, load balancer people. So arguably, every time you're doing something on the web, you can model that problem as serverless. And if you opt to do so, you kind of liberate yourself and get all these properties. Like, you can move from cloud to cloud. You can go to the edge and meet your customer there. You can focus only on a smaller surface of the problem. A common problem with JavaScript that bit me so many times throughout my career, especially with JavaScript running on the server, was if anything goes wrong with your process, with your server, you bring down everyone with it. So I'll give you an example. You have, you know, 100 requests coming in, some for your API, some for like Express.js static file serving and whatnot. And something goes wrong somewhere. So the process crashes, like the infamous at this point, unhandled promise rejection problem, for example, or a memory leak, which are supremely common in a language like JavaScript. So when your server crashes, it literally brings everyone else that was come into that place. A very interesting aspect of serverless functions, as I mentioned, you can think of them as static assets, and they're all sort of independent units of execution. So if 100 customers come to your application and one has a problem, the problem is limited to the invocation of that function. And I cannot describe how many headaches this model will save you. And like I said, it's not even just talking about our solution. It's all about the model that has been sort of this liberating discovery that many people in the industry are sort of making.
What's the like reliability of serverless? I mean, you know, it's always the like, you know, you're just using somebody else's server in the cloud. You know, what is, in your experience, what's been like the uptime reliability of serverless?
The reliability of it, I think is what it's best at, because of this idea that I mentioned, that you can almost imagine that the requests that come in to your system are sort of the health checks to your system. So if you've ever written a server correctly, you might know that you have to write what's called health probes or health checks. It's kind of like if you have a server just sitting around there permanently, it's almost like every once in a while you have to go to your server and, hey, are you okay? Are you still connected to the database? Yeah. Is everything? It's like you pray.
We have a whole Slack channel dedicated to like, okay, can you reboot the server?
Exactly. So. Like, you're like, server, are you okay? You pray to it. You sort of like, you massage it a little bit. And you have to do this every 5 seconds. So in practice, obviously, you tend to like set up this like automated health checks and whatnot. And then there's another problem that comes there. Like, you can't just write a health check that says, are you okay? It's almost like you have to ask the server everything about its life. Like, server, are you okay? Are you connected to the database? Can you resolve DNS? Do you have enough memory? Are you not, in an infinite loop deadlock there? It's like you have to like ask it for like the entire state of the world. Serverless doesn't need you at all. There's not even a way of doing this. It doesn't need you to write health checks at all. Because what happens is, you can imagine, it's almost like lots of mini servers are booting up and dying all the time. So what happens is, a request comes in and your function gets instantiated, and then it like establishes a TCP, the database connection and so on. And that limits the room of what can go wrong. So you were asking about reliability, and this is where I get really excited, because throughout my career, I've had so many of those situations that you're talking about right now, like the infamous, you know, have you tried unplugging it and plugging it back in? That's what you sign up for when you use servers. You sign up for eventually at some point, someone noticing that some state somewhere went wrong, and you have to turn it off and turn it back on again. Serverless functions are always turning off and turning back on again. So they naturally...
they just kind of accepted that natural reality.
Yeah. And although you can't really control it, to be fair. Like, sometimes it will recycle itself and sometimes...
There are a few rules that once you start using the system, you understand that there are certain optimizations that go in. And obviously, you know, it doesn't solve every last problem in the universe. But like I said, this is kind of how people started doing web servers to begin with, way back in the day. And then, yeah, you mentioned, you know, we took a lot of detours. We made deployment really hard. We, you know, had to like get FTP credentials, et cetera. But I always say in technology, the progress is not always linear. And I think sometimes there's a few, like 10 steps forward, and in some situations, one step back. And I do think that this is one of those cases where by yourself opting into a simplified model of execution, what we call a scheduler. So when you use a simple scheduler, which is a way of handling incoming work, you basically just have simpler operational experience, and you can focus on your business and you can focus on your website. I mean, every single day, I think what I try to remind my team of is, you know, our experience is all about the pixels on the screen, the replies in the command line, how fast our APIs are, and it's not really about what kind of infrastructure we decide to run on. So I think it's all about saving energy and time.
This episode of Shop Talk Show is brought to you by Jetpack. You know, the WordPress plugin that does all kinds of stuff for your self-hosted WordPress site. I use it on every single self-hosted WordPress site I have because I just love the feature set. One of the feature set things that's pretty cool is you just flip it on. You know, there's a bunch of these like light switch features in Jetpack where you're just like, do you want this? Yes. Switch it on. Now you have it. You know, it requires no configuration, no fancy stuff. And you just get some improvement from it. One of them is that they have like an image CDN called Photon. So if you have no image solution other than just like hosting your own images on your own website, you'll almost certainly benefit from this. You just flip it on and then your images are hosted on their CDN called Photon, which is already good because CDN hosted images are just an improvement, of course, but it helps optimize them. And you know, because your site already does responsive images anyway, you have that. I've talked about this before. They just improved this feature. They call it Site Accelerator now that does your images as well, but it's starting to host more and more files on their CDN for you. So this new one is that anything that ships with WordPress Core, any file that they can count on that is hosted in that way that your site uses for some reason, when you flip this feature on, is also CDN hosted now. So that's pretty cool. I'm going to run some tests pretty soon, I think, on like a self-hosted WordPress site with none of this stuff turned on, and then flip it on and see what kind of speed improvements are there, because they're definitely there, especially if you test in different locations around the world, farther away from your kind of home-based server and all that. So the new Site Accelerator feature in Jetpack 6.7, I've just been like, hey, cool. Hey, thanks for the help.
So I have a question I do want to talk about next, but this when you design like a API or something that you're or just you kind of auto chunk it up, it sounds like a bit. But let's say I have a CRUD app and I have whatever posts in my CRUD app that's create, read, update, delete. When I push a serverless function, it is like the create a post function, is that its own separate application, or is there kind of like a user application? How granular does it get, or do I not even need to understand that?
That's a good question. I think it's useful to understand that there is a huge advantage to being granular, because imagine that you have an application that has, you know, 100 API endpoints. How neat would it be? And this is kind of the crux. If there is one takeaway of servers versus serverless, this is, in my mind, the crux of the question. When you have 100 API endpoints and you change one, and I the other way that I described it is front-end developers, if you have 100 pages and you fix one typo, what would you rather do? Would you rather rebuild the entire server and redeploy it in its entirety? And keep in mind that projects just grow, especially successful ones. So things could be 10 endpoints today, 100 API endpoints tomorrow, 1,000 in the next month. Or would you rather change one function and redeploy that? And that's what our system does. But it kind of works like React. So if you are familiar with React, you always tell it, hey, re-render the whole thing. That's what you tell now. You're like, hey, now here's my entire project. Do your thing. So what now is going to do is, if, for example, if you have an API directory and you have a bunch of files in there, like users.js, index.js, like sessions files, or you have even more granular stuff like functions directory, we'll go and package each one of them. And then we are smart, kind of like the whole VDOM diff, like React diff approach of the DOM. If something changed under the hood, we only redeploy that. And this just has like tremendous efficiency advantages. So to give you an idea, when we package servers into containers, the smallest server, the smallest container, and you can check up on this later on after the show, the smallest Node.js container you could possibly create after gzip compression level 9 is 40 megabytes or so. And like there's some tricks, and you can like use different base operating systems or whatever. Like it's somewhere between like 25 to like 55 megabytes. In comparison, a serverless function of a Node.js application ends up being just the scripts that make up that serverless function. So some of our customers have mini Express apps, mini Express.js apps that are serving a part of their application, a particular endpoint, and they are like 200 kilobytes. So it's rare that in a field like ours, you start to see, you know, 100x improvements overnight in a particular dimension of the problem. In this case, deployment time tends to be much, much, much faster. Application size ends up being much, much faster. Like I said, room for error as a result of like this smaller granularity ends up being much better. Nowadays, we have technologies like TypeScript that prevent a lot of human error. But I've seen a lot of times where like one typo in one API endpoint, if that typo makes it into the container, then you boot up the container and boom, it's all broken. So there's this idea that if you take advantage of the granularity, as I mentioned, you get all these nice properties, smaller payloads going to the cloud. It's kind of, you know, like what I like about all of this, and this is a great show to be on, is that we're mirroring what happened with the web platform. And this is a good segue into Next.js as well. So the web platform taught us that we have distinct URLs to distinct resources. The URL is the universal resource locator. Each of those resources can, you know, execute code dynamically or serve something from a cache, from a CDN, et cetera. Furthermore, when we respond, we want to only respond with what the customer needs. We want to give them a bundle that's practically reasonable in size, like so that you're not downloading things that you're never going to need, or, you know, like megabytes and megabytes of JavaScript, megabytes of CSS. And this is what we're starting to see in the cloud as well, is when you were editing the equivalent of one page or one API endpoint, we were forcing the redeployment of the entirety of the server infrastructure. And it's kind of, you know, pointless, because the web has this neat system that is already breaking things down into distinct entry points. And this is what this entire system takes advantage of.
So for Dave, your CRUD example is interesting though. So if we're gonna, it probably might be smart then to write four functions separately, and I would think
sometimes what we recommend is like sometimes businesses think of objects, like you want to deal with invoices, and perhaps you can handle your get and delete method and post method in the same function. I'll give you a great example. A very nice practice of Rust is typically that when you operate on an object, you still want to return it the way that it is now. So if you post, you want to do almost like the equivalent of a get in the same transaction. So sometimes the code is so common anyways between different methods of the CRUD application that sometimes you do want to have one type of object and then different HTTP methods inside. But typically, like the advantage of serverless is that you can be very, very granular. It even helps with like team organization. Like teams can say, oh, this is my part of the app, you know, and if I, you know, make it slower and not making it slower the other part of the app that someone else is in charge of. And serverless gives you sort of this nice insight into how the application is evolving.
Yeah, that stuff will be interesting to shake out. Because also, like, if it's a CRUD app, it needs to connect to some kind of data source. And if I have six functions that I need to teach all six of them how to connect to the same data source, it seems like a little wasteful. I'm sure there's interesting ways to handle that kind of problem.
Yeah. Like I said, what's interesting is that we've had that problem with React, right? So the React community ended up saying, like, oh, if five components need the same thing, let's use this common abstraction instead of, usually it's import and it's some functional primitive. We do see that, like, we're all headed into this direction. Like, React just, you know, changed everything to be functional. And hooks are in some ways, reminiscent of monads in some ways. So on the server side, we're seeing the same thing. It's like you this function gets invoked and you need to get some data. So you need to, like, connect to a database, and then you have to issue some side effect, and then you have to return some stuff. So in the case of React, you return JSX. In the case of Node, you return a object that gets JSON serialized. So there is this amazing symmetry that we're already witnessing. It's super inspiring to me, because, like, I can see how by giving people these abstractions, we are, you know, enabling them. Like, we're enabling anyone to be a React developer, but we're also enabling them to be a backend developer, all in one monorepo that they deploy always within the same fashion.
So that monorepo is a word we haven't touched on yet, but the idea there is, like, maybe if I have I have my CRUD functions, but I also need, like, a website to show the invoices or whatever.
Correct.
So
correct.
I could have one one repository that deals with all my functions, or one repository per function or something like that. I might even assume that that's what I need to do if I need to deploy them separately. And you're saying that's not the case. I can put all of my functions and my website into one repository.
Like I said, correct. Because we're going, and this is what we also found out in the React ecosystem, right? Like, the jQuery way was, hey, let's granularly select a DOM element and change it. And that's what would happen if you were and say, hey, I'm going to go to my function, I'm going to change this function directly. But what React taught us is, hey, why don't you tell me exactly what you want in its entirety? And that's what we do for deployment, is you run now or you get push, and we deploy the entire repo. Now, the question is, like, okay, how is that not super slow? And it's the same with React. Like, how is it not super slow? It's, well, later you can do some optimizations. You can have caches, you can do deduping. But what matters is what abstraction you're giving to the developer. And yeah, the average developer needs a front end and a back end. Like, you can't make one work without the other. So we encourage people to model their interfaces as monorepos. So you put your front end code in one folder, for example, and your back end code in another folder. Sometimes people have several front ends. Like, you might have your back office, and you might have your front end, and you might have your marketing website. This even allows you to experiment with different technologies. Like, say, hey, like, and now I'm going to try Vue for the marketing pages. Or I want to use Next for my dashboard, and I want to use Gatsby for my front end. But I want to have a common React component system that both folders share. And that's where the beauty of the monorepo kind of starts to show.
That's interesting. You advocate for that, because it like monorepo and monoliths tend to have, like, this really negative connotation. But
And it's a very heavily debated topic, but our take is monoliths. Okay, this is fact. Okay, no discussion here. Monoliths are incredibly successful. So GitHub is a monolith. GitHub.com is a Rails monolith.
Gmail.
Shopify.com is a Rails monolith. A lot of things that work extremely well, that you can go on Robinhood and buy their stocks, and they're like 100 gazillion billion dollar companies. You go to their GitHub, or you go to their thing, and the back end is like, oh, it's this gigantic thing. So exhibit A, it works. But our argument is, all of the things that I said about servers were like, you fix one typo and you rebuild the entire thing and you move a gigantic container over. That's not what you want. But what I think made those companies really successful is that all their teams and all their API endpoints and all their front end had this common vision of the world. When you onboard a new person to your team and you're like, okay, here's the project. Oh, it's just one folder. Oh, and you deployed it with literally three letters now. That's what you want. And a monolith is always a monorepo. But a monorepo doesn't have to be a monolith to be successful. A monorepo that has, like, React front end and serverless functions and whatnot is the right way to build something today. And it'll give you this feeling that you're operating on what DHH famously called the majestic monolith, because it works so well for him, right? So it's not only GitHub or Shopify, it's also Basecamp and numerous companies that have seen success with this.
This episode of Shop Talk Show was brought to you in part by Flywheel. That's getflywheel.com, which is WordPress hosting. Perhaps you've heard of Local by Flywheel, which has kind of taken the local development environment for WordPress community by storm. You know, I feel like I used MAMP for like 10 years and it like still exists. And if you use it, that's fine. I'm not like crapping on MAMP or anything, but it like Local by Flywheel to me blows any other choice out of the water. For one, I kind of like little UIs. I like a UI for my Git. I like a UI for all kinds of stuff. Not that I'm like afraid of command line stuff. Sometimes I just like it though. Local by Flywheel is like an app. It sits in your dock on your Mac, or it works for Windows too, which is relevant to us because we are redesigning the Shop Talk Show website, and I recently moved hosts for it too. So that's the connection between these things. Of course, I run WordPress locally on my machine with Local by Flywheel. So I spin up shoptalkshow.local on my local machine to work on the WordPress site. And Dave can work on it too, because Local by Flywheel just spins right up on his Windows environment too. So now we're a team and we can work together. But, you know, moving the site was so great because right in local, like there's just like a button, like connect to Flywheel, boop, connected, send it up to Flywheel, boop. You know, it's like two buttons and it shoots up our whole site to Flywheel hosting. You get like a little subdomain. You can make sure it's all right. You map the DNS over to the Flywheel hosting and boom, it's moved. I feel like I was like, oh, I want to get this site on over on Flywheel. You know, this is, you know, I'll maybe section off the morning to get this done. Hopefully I can get pretty far. Maybe I'll get it done. And then it's like 30 minutes later, it's done. You know, I love that when you find like this hosting product is so good, so easy to use, helps you with local development and live development. Plus, I'm in there like, do you want to turn the CD on? Click CDN on? Click here. Right. You want SSL on it? Click here. Derp, derp, derp. It's this beautiful UI internally. You know, I kind of started to like demand that from my host too. I'm like, this is a paid software product. Should be a, have a nice, you know, clear, intuitive UI. And of course it does. So anyway, love Flywheel. Love Local by Flywheel. Love it all. It's great for us. We use it here on Shop Talk Show to power our WordPress site. Let's morph into the next stuff if we could. So, you know, fans of React, as we may be here, React is kind of notorious for not giving you all that much out of the box, right? At this point, it doesn't even give you React DOM. You got to grab that separately. But it certainly doesn't give you routing. It doesn't give you, you know, global state management. There's all kinds of stuff that kind of doesn't give you perhaps on purpose. And one thing it definitely doesn't give you is routing, like I said, and any kind of server-side rendering kind of thing. So that was a gap in the market. People want that. And Next was there for it, right? Am I right on there? Or do you?
Yeah. And funny enough, all those examples that I mentioned are apps that use a lot of static websites, but primarily are server-rendered websites. Because when you grow to a certain point, you need to like query a database and a data source and respond dynamically. And if you look at a project like Create React App or a lot of projects where you run a build process, they typically are a monolith. So going back to the analogy, when you use, I'm not sure about Vue, but perhaps it is this way out of the box. When you use any of these projects, they yield one app.js file and one .app.css file. And that is the first thing we noticed. And we said, oh, that seems like it's not going to scale. You know, you keep adding functionality. One day you say, hey, like, I'm going to add this like super cool rich text editor. And then, you know, like the app bundle is just going to get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. So that app bundle and that monolithic single page application is this quote unquote server of the front end world. So Next.js makes React serverless in the sense that what we have you do is you create a pages directory, and inside of the pages directory, you create all your entry points into your application, akin to serverless functions. So you create index.js, settings.js, about.js, all your pages. And all those pages are just functions that return React components.
It feels like server-side routing in a way, and that just it's just like each one of those pages is a full is just a it's like a folder with a called about with an index.html file in it.
Yeah, correct. And in this case, it's index.js, and index.js returns a React tree, and you can do server stuff, server rendering as well. So you know, you just create your directory. And another amazing thing that we hear a lot is that when you have the monolithic single page application design, it's hard for people to like learn their way around the application. Whereas with Next.js and now, you open the application, you open the folder, and you're like, oh, there's a pages directory. And then you're like, oh, all the, these are all my public URLs. And we do a lot of automatic stuff for you as a result. Like we can do code splitting of bundles. So each of your pages becomes a bundle of code, like a JS bundle or a CSS bundle that is specific to that page. And it just scales really well. Like, and if you wanted, here's the paradox. If you wanted to have a single page application, you would just create pages/index.js and you would put all your life there. But what we encourage you to do, and I think what happens very naturally, is you start creating one page per route that you have. And then we expose them automatically.
Does it hydrate into an SPA then, or not really? Does it stay? It's like what happens when you click from one page to the other?
Oh, that's a great question. So we give you a component called link that allows you to link between pages. And the beautiful thing is that we load those pages, kind of like how Turbo Links works.
Really, it's a Turbo Links approach. Oh, that's cool.
It's like a Turbo Link, but it's actually a little bit more sophisticated. So Turbo Link.
I knew Turbo Links was a good idea. Damn it.
I know. It's a great idea.
It's a freaking great idea. Like, I mean, all this stuff has worked really well. Like, again, like we are doing a few touches that we think are step forward. So in this case, what we do is we prefetch, which I don't know if TurboLinks does, but TurboLinks cannot do this because if they prefetch, they would be adding all this load to your database. So what we do is we prefetch just the instructions for rendering. So we prefetch just like the skeleton of the, like the React code basically, but not the data. So what and the data actually you can prefetch optionally because if you want to you know have more load in your database but benefit your users, go for it. So when you have this link component that we give you, which in itself is optional as well, by the way, like Next tries to not really get into your way. So what's going to happen is we're going to prefetch the thing that we're linking to, and then when you click or when you interact with that hyperlink, we probably already have the page preloaded. So it feels exactly like a single page application, which is ultimately what customers have always wanted. Like, who wants a slow loading website? Who wants page transitions to be slow?
No, but does it do like a history push state thing, or does it do like it does.
Okay. That's managed by Next.js. So what's neat about that is that we can do a lot of optimizations by having that power on the client side. And we still have a very minimal runtime. It doesn't mean that like Next is adding a lot of code for you. And it's very, very natural. Like one of the things that we decided to do is like, let's mimic the behavior of a web browser exactly. So like when you click a link, we just replace the entire React tree of one page with the next entire React tree. But this is a few things that, for example, customers can do once they have this power. They can retain state between page and page. So they can have caches, they can have local state, they can have pieces of JavaScript that have already been loaded that are very expensive. Like imagine CodePen, right? Like the text editor and syntax highlighting code and all that is super expensive. So when we transition from page to page, we can keep as much stuff in memory as you want. Which allows you to do all sorts of really neat things like transitions, page transitions, animations.
Oh, believe me, we're trying to get there, man. It's close. Don't worry.
Awesome.
But that's great. So, and it knows the magic part to me is like, okay, well, you have all these different entry points. There's a index.js and there's a product.js. And then you load index.js and enough time goes that it hydrates itself or whatever it does. I don't even know if you use that term or
we
what.
Do.
But then you click onto a product page and
and it enough JavaScript is executed that it's going to behave in this SPA type of way. But it needs new stuff because maybe there's some tabs on the product page, right? And it doesn't. The first bundle didn't have the tabs in it, so it didn't download.
What's really neat is like when you went to index, which could be your marketing pages, right? Like sometimes it's not even related to what you're going to do next. You only downloaded the bundle that is related to that section of your application. So another great example is when you're in the dashboard, things get in your dashboard, your admin panel or however it is, things tend to get pretty heavy. You start loading a lot of components, et cetera. So you don't want these things to constantly be battling for sort of the user's download bandwidth. The main benefit is that when you enter to that example you gave, the product page, you're not downloading the terms of service. It's funny, but if you go to any SPA that has a page dedicated to terms of service, and you're loading a critical section of your website, that an e-commerce product that you want to sell, as your JS downloads. So first of all, you're going to render a blank page because that's how most SPAs work. Then you're going to start loading some JavaScript. That JavaScript is going to contain even the terms of service, and then it's going to request data, and then it's going to render your product. With Next.js, we go to the page. We already get all the pre-rendered information that we wanted, including all the product, its price, its stock, etc. And then when we download the JS bundle, we only get the JS that's needed for that page.
Sure, it's code splitting, right? But it's managed for you.
Yeah, and the code splitting is happening automatically because you're taking advantage of saying, hey, these are all my pages. There's not one global bundle. The developer doesn't have to go in there and say, like, hey, I'm going to code split here, I'm going to code split there, et cetera.
Like per route code splitting is kind of difficult to set up yourself. I mean, you can shove it into Webpack and it'll give you like 10 bundles if you want, but like it's not necessarily per route. So that's...
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And that's where you start seeing the similarity between serverless functions and server-rendered React applications like Next.js, because just like a serverless function is doing code splitting of your API, Next is doing code splitting of your pages, your public pages, your front-end pages. So it's a beautiful system. It's very coherent.
So then is it like Next plus now then gets me server-side rendered like serverless functions for my front end code that I put, it's kind of all starts happening in concert. Is that right?
Yeah, correct. Like you model your monorepo with your Next application and your API endpoints. And the nice thing is, again, like Next just happens to be one really great candidate, but there is actually, we have great support for Nuxt as well, which is the Vue version of Next. And there are a lot of interesting solutions to this problem. But I think what's interesting is if you use this model, you'll start worrying a lot less about all these different aspects of putting together your application.
Not to throw React under the bus, but it has somewhat of a notorious like performance concern. Google Chrome developers are very, very serious about its performance. Is that kind of the problem you set out to solve? Were you just like, let's fix performance?
Yes, I absolutely. So for example, if you're doing anything dynamic, you're never going to beat the experience of giving the customer in the first hop the information that they wanted. So Next is server rendering. So it's giving you, or pre-rendering as well. Like you can export a pre-rendered version of your app. So you just get all your data in one go, right? So like there is no, and that's just HTML and CSS. So like there's basically no performance problem. The performance problems of React tend to be when you're doing a lot of React and this process that you mentioned, Dave, that's called rehydration. So When it rehydrates, and this is what Chrome developers kind of go nuts about, is the time to interactive, TTI. So a React application or even a Next.js page require that, okay, we pre-rendered or server-rendered, and then we load the code, and then that code attaches all the event listeners and whatnot, and then it can do some interaction. Next actually kind of solved this problem as well that React has, because remember that I mentioned that we have this link component. But all this link component is doing is it's using a regular anchor HTML element. So it's like a normal hyperlink. So even if the JS hasn't loaded, you can still click around and you're going to go to other pages, which themselves are pre-rendered or server-rendered. So when you go to them, like it's all probably going to work a lot better than if you were to do it yourself. But what Chrome developers really pick on is, imagine that you're rendering a product page and you have a buy button. And that buy button renders a modal and has to load Stripe and then, you know, ask for your credit card details. Yep. And that's all like client-side JavaScript stuff. So for that JavaScript to work, then you have to sort of be mindful of how big is my bundle. Like in this case, because it's only per page, it's probably not bad. Thanks to Next. Thank you, Next. Or you have to be mindful of, okay, open the timeline and be like, okay, like how long is React taking to rehydrate and so on and so forth. One nice thing that I've observed with a lot of customers, because this is used by Hulu.com. So if you just watched the Fyre Festival documentary, you've probably used Next.js. The key thing that all of these customers have noticed is you kind of always want to have URLs because that's when the web works best. So one thing I encourage is if you're going to have a buy modal, so you press on the buy button and you render a modal, you can also attach a URL to that. So your URL can become via, and if it happens on the client side, it's going to be via push state. It's going to become /products/Fyre Festival/buy. So here's a really cool thing. Next.js kind of puts you into this pit of success. It's like you succeed or you succeed, because if you use a URL system, then you copy and paste that URL, you send it to a friend, and that interaction is always going to work, even if it's a modal, because Next knows when it first loads, oh, the URL looks like this, let's match it to this. Even if it's a modal or some complex interaction like that, it kind of all works very naturally, just like the original web did. So yeah, there are some performance problems that React has, but I would say that most of them, Next.js, because of its model, kind of prevents you from going into. And now that's where Chrome developers just generically say that all apps need some sort of budget or boundary to be very successful. And that I tend to agree with that because I've seen so many now where, you know, you launch your new application, it's super fast the first day, and then you kept adding stuff. You didn't quite measure Lighthouse every single day of your life. And then 6 months later, all your bundles are bigger and it's not as fast anymore. So the other question that goes in there, which is why Google invented AMP, is like, okay, what are the right constraints to introduce so that you don't accidentally fall off the cliff, even though we put into this success path? What can we do to make you not fail in terms of like, oh, I accidentally brought in a huge dependency and now my JS bundle is 10 megabytes?
I saw a demo just the other day. I was at a local meetup here and it was Paul Armstrong's developer came and showed Next and just did a live coded here's how we might build this little website Next. It was really, really cool. And, you know, at the end here, this is what the page did. It you know, loaded up a little React app. But what the React app's job was to go get a meetup from meetup.com and say what the name of the meetup and when it is. So there's a little bit of data fetching that it had to do, you know. And so it built it in Next, and there was a URL for it and all that stuff worked. And it was cool because then he ran the build, and the build itself could go make that data request and then build the page out of it. And the output of it was an actual, you know, an HTML file that had the Next meetup data right in it. So you're like, this is actually SSR. And beyond that, it's statically rendered too. It's not just, when I think of SSR, there's a version of SSR which is like, ask the server for a page. The server might then go make the request for the data and ultimately return a page. And that kind of SSR is cool too, because you still get JavaScript doesn't have to do the rendering of the thing. You get that document and it can render it right away. But this is kind of both, right? It's server-side rendered and it'll hydrate itself.
Yeah.
For
yeah, absolutely. So we call that pre-rendering. So to us, they're both the same technology. So think of it as lazily fetching data, right? So you can fetch data when the customer hits your application, or you can fetch the data ahead of time. It's also a little bit like ahead of time compilation or just in time compilation. So it's like ahead of time data fetching at build time, or just in time data fetching upon request. And there are use cases for both. So some customers have very static data sets. So think of it as a meetup, like you said, like you're building a very simple website for a meetup that you're going to host, and you want to get some data dynamically, like your speakers or bios, and you're fine that whenever like data changes, you want to rebuild and recompute the whole thing. And your API backend can take the load of fetching all that data at build time. But there are a lot of customers that have gigantic data sets. So imagine that every time you build, you request, we have a customer that has hotels. So tens of thousands of hotels every time you build. It's impossible. So, or I mean, it is possible. Everything is possible, Zumbo.com, but it's not practical. So Next puts the developer in control. Like if you want to at build time fetch all your data, do that. But we also give you the flexibility to say, oh, like if my data set is larger, I can fetch it on demand.
That's smart. I think I am coming up to a hard stop here, but Guillermo, you've been famously quoted here, at least in my Twitter stream, is React is such a good idea that we will spend the rest of the decade continuing to explore its implications and applications. I'd love like the 2-minute version of like what do you think some of those implications are, like that, how React has changed the game.
It's funny because so I tweeted that in 2016. I don't credit myself with being a super early adopter of React. I would say I was like the second wave, and the first wave is a lot of people that were doing SPAs and with things like Ember or technologies that at the time didn't have quite the React model. But I was still a pretty early adopter. I wrote this article called Pure UI, where I anticipated in a way that we were going to focus more on functions. I remember that Sebastian, today the lead maintainer of, or one of the lead maintainers of React, and I lived very nearby in San Francisco. And one time we ran into each other at a cafe, and I was telling him, like, I'm writing this article, and I don't really want to use a class interface. Why do we have classes? And of course, it took a long time to like take the classes out. It was very difficult, and I didn't even know how to do that. But I had this sort of intuition that, and that's why the article is called Pure UI. It's kind of a pun on that you just should focus purely on your UI, just focus on the UI, but also that you could use pure functions. And when you go and read that article again, you'll see that I really restrained myself from using classes when providing the examples, at the expense of a lot of trouble at the time, because I think at the time React didn't even have stateless functions, but I really wanted to see that idea through, that you could have a F of data outputs UI. That was the idea that I fell in love with. And why do I think that the implications are massive? So first of all, is the switch from object-oriented programming and imperative style of programming to declarative and or functional. And I think we have a few cycles into this idea still. I think you've seen hooks, right? And you've seen this idea of well-delineated effects and segregating the effect and the declaration of the effect from the pure part of your application. I think that needs further elaboration. I think that is a very great direction. I think we need to go all in on that and continue to explore that. I think another set of implications is what's going to happen to React and React Native. So even the fact that you have to explain to people that there is React, but there's also React Native, and then you have to explain the difference between what native is and what not native is, which is also in itself incredibly blurry. Let's not forget that a lot of the applications that we use on a daily basis, we could not have told like 10 years ago if we launched them today. You launch an Electron app, and Electron apps have a lot of problems, right? But they do their job very well with certain like downsides. But most people would never be able to say, oh, yeah, this is a Cocoa native, whatever. No, it just works. So I always tend to look things that I'm the end user, right? And I'm an 80-year-old man. I lost all the React waves. I didn't go to Hacker News ever. And all I care about is the end user experience. And as an end user, I want cohesive experiences, a cohesive design system between a mobile app, a desktop app, and a web app. I want the information to be there. I want all the features to be there, right? Like the most common customer frustration is, oh, I love your responsive website. I want your mobile optimized website, but it doesn't have this feature. I had to switch to desktop mode, and then I had to shrink in, and like I can't even tap. So I think we need to do further development and research into this. And Expo and the React Native team are, you know, very focused on solving this problem, and very excited about that as well. And I think the other thing that's going to always keep us on our toes is that this model works really well, but there's always a point where theory meets practice, right? And like the model might make you a little bit slower and you need escape hatch, or further concurrency models need to be put inside React, like it's happening now. And I think what's also going to happen is like the technologies that we deployed React to are also changing. So we're moving into serverless now. So React has to boot in completely different circumstances. It's still V8 and it's still Node, but there's a lot of optimization to be there because now we have this better model for splitting concurrency into this discrete requests. So I think the server runtime is going to change significantly. React, like you might think of React in the future as the runtime. You're starting to see that React has its own language semantics even, right? Like hooks have rules of hooks. React, for better or for worse, invented JSX, for better, and that's not inside JavaScript. So I think the server runtime, it's almost like you're really just thinking of the server runtime as React. The Node part is interesting that it's there, but you know, like you're not gonna be using Express as much. Like I said, like you just think of like this beautiful world of just writing your pages. You don't think about like, oh, I'm gonna write an Express app and whatnot. So with Next, we're trying to define what this ideal React app is, really, in its true sense, a full React app. And I think, like I said, like I see every day, like there's this Ink project that brings a React model to the terminal. I kind of anticipated that as well a few years ago, but now it's been done so well by someone in the community. Unfortunately, blanking his name, but he did such a great job with like it's so the React model is so good at handling asynchronous data fetching and so on that with this Ink project you can now express very sophisticated command line interfaces with very little code and a lot of simplicity. Like the Jest output is one of their examples with progress bars and a layout system in the terminal. And so we're going to see React in a lot of places, I think. It's going to be a lot of fun.
I think I have to wrap up. I have to leave, but y'all can keep talking, I guess. But, for those who aren't following you, thank you so much, Guillermo, for coming on the show. I know your schedule is very jam packed, so we really appreciate it. For those who aren't following you and giving you money, how can they do that?
Yeah. So to follow us, go to twitter.com/ZeitHQ, like Z-E-I-T. HQ. And I think that's a really great starting point to learn about every project, follow all of us that work there. Our pinned tweet usually contains the most up-to-date information about us. So yeah, ZEITHQ on Twitter.
Awesome. Well, thank you very much. And thank you, dear listener, for downloading this in your podcatcher choice. Be sure to star, heart, favorite it up. That's how people find out about the show. And follow us on Twitter @ShopTalkShow for tens of tweets a month. And if you hate your job, head over to shoptalkshow.com/jobs and get a brand new one because people want to hire people like you. And Chris, do you have anything else you'd like to say?
No, shoptalkshow.com.